Lord Albert Salacci didn't much like parties. There was too much politics, and he particularly didn't like this one because it meant he was in the same room as Lord Winder, a man who deep down he believed to be a bad sort. In his personal vocabulary, there was no greater condemnation. What made it worse was that while seeking to avoid him, he also had to try at the same time to avoid Lord Venturi. Their families cordially detested one another. Lord Albert wasn't sure now what event in history had caused the rift, but it must have been important, obviously, otherwise it would be silly to go on like this. Had the Salacci and the Venturi been hill clans, they would have been a feud-in and a fight-in. Since they were two of the city's leading families, they were chillingly, viciously, icily polite to each other whenever social fate forced them together. And right now his careful orbit of the less dangerously political areas of the damn party had brought him face to face with Lord Charles Venturi. It was bad enough having to campaign with the fellow, he thought, without being forced to talk to him over some rather inferior wine, but currently the party's tides offered no way of escape without being impolite. And, curiously, upper-class etiquette in Ankh-Morpork held that, while you could snub your friends any time you felt like it, it was the height of bad form to be impolite to your worst enemy.
"Venturi,"
he said, raising his glass a carefully calculated fraction of an inch.
"Salacci,"
said Lord Venturi, doing the same thing.
"This is a party," said Albert.
"Indeed, I see you are standing upright."
"Indeed, so are you, I see."
"Indeed, indeed. On that subject, I note many others are doing the same thing."
"Which is not to say that the horizontal position does not have its merits when it comes to, for example, sleeping," said Albert.
"Quite so. Obviously, that would not be done here."
"Oh, indeed, indeed."
The Salacci and the Venturi made a point, on occasions like this, to talk only about things on which there was no possibility of disagreement. Given the history of the two families, this had become a very small number of things. A brisk lady in a magnificent purple dress advanced across the ballroom floor, her smile travelling in front of her.
"Lord Salacci," she said, proffering her hand, "I hear you have been doing sterling work defending us from the mob."
His lordship, on social automatic pilot, bowed stiffly. He wasn't used to forward women, and this one was all forward. However, all safe topics of conversation with the Venturi had been exhausted.
"I fear you have the advantage of me, madam," he murmured.
"I certainly expect so," said madam, giving him such a radiant smile that he didn't analyse her actual words. "And who is this imposing military gentleman, a comrade in arms?"
Lord Salacci floundered. He'd been brought up knowing that you always introduced men to women, and this smiling lady hadn't told him her...
"Lady Roberta Mezzarole," she said. "Most people who know me call me madam, but my friends call me Bobby."
Lord Venturi clicked his heels. He was quicker on the uptake than his comrade in arms, and his wife told him more of the current gossip.
"Ah, must be the lady from Genoa," he said, taking her hand. "I have heard so much about you."
"Anything good?" said madam.
His lordship glanced across the room. His wife appeared to be deep in conversation. He knew to his cost that her wifely radar could fry an egg half a mile away, but the champagne had been good.
"Mostly expensive," he said,
which didn't sound quite as witty as he intended. She laughed anyway. Perhaps I was witty, he thought. I say, this champagne really is excellent.
"A woman has to make her way in the world as best she can," she said.
"May I make so bold as to ask if there is a Lord Mezzarole?" he said.
"So early in the evening," said madam, and laughed again.
Lord Venturi found himself laughing with her. "My word," he told himself, "this wit is a lot easier than I thought."
"No, of course, I meant," he began.
"I'm sure you did," said madam, tapping him lightly with her fan. "Now, I mustn't monopolize you, but I really must drag both of you away to talk to some of my friends."
She took Lord Venturi by the unresisting arm and piloted him across the floor. Salacci followed morosely, being of the opinion that when respectable women called themselves Bobby, the world was about to end and ought to.
"Mr. Carter has extensive interest in copper, and Mr. Jones is very interested in rubber," she whispered.
There were about six men in the group, talking in low voices.
As their lordships approached, they caught. "And at a time like this, one really must ask oneself where one's true loyalties lie. Oh, good evening, madam." On her apparently random walk to the buffet table, Madame happened to meet several other gentlemen and, like a good hostess, piloted them in the direction of other small groups. Probably only someone lying on the huge beams that spanned the hall high above would spot any pattern, and even then they'd have to know the code. If they had been in a position to put a red spot on the heads of those people who were not friends of the patrician, and a white spot on those who were his cronies, and a pink spot on those who were perennial waverers, then they would have seen something like a dance taking place. There were not many whites. They would have seen that there were several groups of reds, and white spots were being introduced into them in ones, or twos if the number of reds in the group was large enough. If a white left a group, he or she was effortlessly scooped up and shunted into another conversation, which might contain one or two pinks, but was largely red. Any conversation entirely between white spots was gently broken up with a smile and an, "Oh, but now you must meet," or was joined by several red spots. Pinks, meanwhile, were delicately passed from red group to red group until they were deeply pink, and then they were allowed to mix with other pinks of the same hue under the supervision of a red. In short, the pinks met so many reds and so few whites that they probably forgot about whites at all, while the whites, constantly alone or hugely outnumbered by reds or deep pinks, appeared to be going red out of embarrassment or a desire to blend in. Lord Winder was entirely surrounded by reds, leaving the few remaining whites out in the cold. He looked like all the patricians tended to look after a certain time in office, unpleasantly plump, with the pink jowliness of a man of normal build who had too much rich food. He was sweating slightly in this quite cool room, and his eyes swiveled this way and that, looking for the flaws, the clues, the angles. At last, Madame reached the buffet, where Dr. Follett was helping himself to the devilled eggs, and Miss Rosemary Palm was debating with herself as to whether the future should contain strange pastry things with a green filling that hinted mysteriously of prawn.
"And how are we doing, do you think?"
said Dr. Follett, apparently to a swan carved out of ice.
"We are doing well," Madame told a basket of fruit. "There's four, however, that are still proving awkward."
"I know them," said the doctor. "They'll fall into place, trust me. What else can they do? We're used to this game here. We know that if you complain too loudly when you lose, you might not be asked to play again. But I shall station some stout friends near them, just in case their resolve needs a little bolstering."
"He is suspicious," said Miss Palm.
"When isn't he?" said Dr. Follett. "Go and talk to him."
"Where is our new best friend, Doctor?" said Madame.
"Mr. Snapcase is dining quietly but visibly in impeccable company some way away."
They turned when the double doors opened, so did several of the other guests, and then turned back hastily. But it was only a servant, who hurried over to Madame and whispered something. She indicated the two military commanders, and the man went over to hover anxiously beside them. There was a brief exchange, and then, without even a bow towards Lord Winder, all three men went out.
"I shall just go and see to the arrangements," said Madame, and without in any sense following the men, headed towards the doors.
When she stepped into the hall, the two servants waiting by the cake stopped lounging and snapped to attention, and a guard who was patrolling the corridor gave her a quick glance of interrogation.
"Now, Madame?" said one of the servants. "What? Oh, no, just wait."
She glided over to where the commanders were in animated conversation with a couple of junior officers, and took Lord Venturi's arm.
"Oh, dear, Charles, are you leaving us so soon?"
Lord Venturi didn't think of wondering how she knew his first name. The champagne had been plentiful, and he saw no reason at the moment why any attractive woman of a certain age shouldn't know his name.
"Oh, there are one or two pockets of resistance left," he said. "Nothing to concern you, madam."
"Bloody big pocket," murmured Lord Salarchi into his moustache.
"They destroyed Big Mary, sir," said the luckless messenger, "and they—" "Major Mountjoy Standfast can't outthink a bunch of gormless watchmen and civilians and some veterans with garden forks," said Lord Venturi,
who had no idea of how much damage a garden fork could do if hurled straight down from an elevation of 20 feet.
"That's just it, sir. They are veterans, and they know all—" "And the civilians, unarmed civilians," said Venturi.
The messenger, who was a sub-lieutenant and very nervous, couldn't find the right words to explain that unarmed civilian was stretching a point when it was a 200-pound slaughterhouse man with a long hook in one hand and a flensing knife in the other. Young men who'd joined up for the uniforms and a bed all to themselves did not expect that kind of treatment.
Permission to speak freely, sir,
he tried.
Very well.
The men haven't got the heart for it, sir. They'd kill a Clatchian in a wink, sir, but, well, some of the old soldiers are from the regiment, sir, and they're shouting down all kinds of stuff. A lot of the men come from down there, and it's not good for them. And what some of the old ladies shout, sir, well, I've never heard such language. Dolly's sisters are bad enough, sir, but this is a bit too much. Sorry, sir.
Their lordships looked out the window. There was half a regiment in the palace grounds, men who'd had nothing to do for several days but stand guard.
"Some backbone and a quick thrust," said Solachi. "That's what's needed by Io. Lance the boil. This is not a cavalry action, Venturi, and I'll take those men, fresh blood."
"Solachi, we do have orders."
"We have all kinds of orders," said Solachi. "But we know where the enemy is, don't we? Aren't there enough guards here? How many guards does one fool need?"
"We can't just—"
Lord Venturi began, but Madame said,
"I'm sure Charles will see that no harm comes to his lordship."
And she took his arm.
"He does have his sword, after all."
A few minutes later, Madame glanced out the window and saw that the troops were quietly moving out. She also noticed, after watching for some time, that the guard patrolling in the hall seemed to have vanished. There were rules. When you had a guild of assassins, there had to be rules which everyone knew and which were never, ever broken. Sometimes, admittedly, for a given value of never. An assassin, a real assassin, had to look like one. Black clothes, hood, boots and all. If they could wear any clothes, any disguise, then what could anyone do but spend all day sitting in a small room with a loaded crossbow pointed at the door? And they couldn't kill a man incapable of defending himself. Although a man worth more than 10,000 Ankh-Morpork pork dollars a year was considered automatically capable of defending himself, or at least of employing people to do it for him. And they had to give the target a chance. But there was no helping some people. It was regrettable how many rulers of the city had been inhumed by the men in black, because they didn't recognise a chance when they saw it, didn't know when they'd gone too far, didn't care that they'd made too many enemies, didn't read the signs, didn't know when to walk away after embezzling a moderate and acceptable amount of cash. They didn't realise it when the machine had stopped, when the world was ripe for change, when it was time, in fact, to spend more time with their family in case they ended up spending it with their ancestors. Of course, the guild didn't inhume their rulers on their own behalf. There was a rule about that, too. They were simply there when needed. There was a tradition once, far back in the past, called King of the Bean. A special dish was served to all the men of their clan on a certain day of the year. It contained one small, hard-baked bean, and whoever got the bean was, possibly after some dental attention, hailed as king. It was quite an inexpensive system, and it worked well, probably because the clever little bald men who actually ran things and paid some attention to possible candidates were experts at palming a bean into the right bowl. And while the crops ripened and the tribe thrived and the land was fertile, the king thrived too. But when, in the fullness of time, crops failed and the ice came back and the animals were inexplicably barren, the clever little bald men sharpened their long knives, which were mostly used for cutting mistletoe. And on the due night, one of them went into his cave and carefully baked one small bean. Of course, that was before people were civilised. These days, no one had to eat beans. People were still working on the barricade. It had become a sort of general hobby, a kind of group home improvement. Fire buckets, some full of water, some of sand, had turned up. In places, the barricade was more impregnable than the city walls, considering how often the latter had been pillaged for stone. There were occasional drumbeats down in the city, and the sound of troop movements.
"Sergeant?"
Vimes looked down. A face had appeared at the top of the ladder leading down into the street.
"Ah, Miss Batty, I didn't know you were with us."
"I didn't intend to be, but suddenly there was this big wall."
She climbed all the way up. She was holding a small bucket.
"Dr. Lorne presents his compliments and says how come you haven't beaten anyone up yet?"
she said, putting it down.
He says he's got 3 tables scrubbed, 2 buckets of tar on the boil, 6 ladies rolling bandages, and all he's had to deal with so far is a nosebleed. You've let him down, he says.
Tell him ha, 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 said Vimes.
I've brought you up some breakfast, said Sandra, and Vimes realised that down below, doing their not very best to remain unseen, were some of the lads. They were sniggering.
Mushrooms, he said.
No, said the girl. I was told to tell you that since it's tomorrow, you're going to get everything you wished for. For a moment, Vimes tensed, not certain where the world was taking him.
A hard-boiled egg, said Sandra.
And Sam Vimes said you probably like the yolk runny and some toast cut up into soldiers.
Just like he does, said Vimes weakly. Good guess, that man.
Vimes tossed the egg up into the air, expecting to catch it when it came down. Instead, there was a noise like scissors closing, and the air rained runny yolk and bits of shell. And then it rained arrows. The noise level of the conversation had gone up. Madam moved in on the group around Lord Winder. Magically, within 10 seconds, they were left alone as all the other people in the group saw people across the room that they really had to talk to.
"Who are you?"
said Winder, his eyes surveying her with that care a man takes when he fears that a woman is carrying concealed weaponry.
"Madame Roberta Mezzerole, my lord."
"The one from Genoa," Winder snorted, which was his attempt at a snigger. "I've heard stories about Genoa."
"I could probably tell you a few more, my lord," said Madame. "But right now it's time for the cake."
"Yeah," said Winder. "Did you know we got another assassin tonight? They keep trying, you know. 11 years and still they try, but I get 'em every time, sneak about though they may."
"Well done, my lord," said Madame.
It did help that he was an unpleasant person, ugly, clear to the bone. In some ways it made things easier. She turned and clapped her hands. Surprisingly, this small noise caused a sudden cessation in the chatter. The double doors at the end of the hall opened and 2 trumpeters appeared. They took up positions on either side of the door.
"Stop 'em!"
Winder yelled and ducked. His 2 guards ran down the hall and grabbed the trumpets from the frightened men. They handled them with extreme care, as if expecting them to explode or issue a strange gas.
"Poison darts," said Winder in a satisfied voice. "Can't be too careful, madam. In this job you learn to watch every shadow. All right, let them play, but no trumpets. I hate tubes pointed at me."
There was some bewildered conversation at the other end of the hall. Then the bereft trumpeters stood back and whistled as best they could. Lord Winder laughed as the cake was pushed in. It was in tiers, about man height, and heavily iced.
"Lovely," he said as the crowd clapped. "I do like some entertainment at a party, and I cut it, do I?"
He took a few steps back and nodded at the bodyguards.
"Off you go, boys," he said.
Swords stabbed into the top tier several times. The guards looked at Winder and shook their heads.
"There's such a thing as dwarves, you know," he said.
They stabbed at the second layer, again meeting no more resistance than can be offered by dried fruit and suet and a crust of marzipan with sugar frosting.
"He could be kneeling down," said Winder.
The audience watched, their smiles frozen. When it became clear that the cake was solid and unoccupied, the food taster was sent for. Most of the guests recognised him. His name was Spymold. He was said to have eaten so much poison in his time that he was proof against anything, and that he ate a toad every day to keep in condition. It was also rumoured that he could turn silver black by breathing on it. He selected a piece of cake and chewed it thoughtfully, staring intently upwards whilst he did so.
"Hmm," he said after a while.
"Well," said Winder.
"Sorry, my lord," said Spymold. "Nothing. I thought there was a touch of cyanide there, but no luck, it's just the almonds."
"No poison at all," said the patrician. "You mean it's edible?"
"Well, yes. It'd be all the better for some toad, of course, but that's just one man's opinion."
"Perhaps the servants can serve it now, my lord," said Madam.
"Don't trust servants serving food," said Winder. "Sneaking about, could slip something in."
"Do you mind if I do it then, my lord?"
"Yeah, all right," said Lord Winder, watching the cake carefully. "I'll have the 9th piece they cut."
But in fact, he snatched the 5th piece triumphantly, as if saving something precious from the wreckage. The cake was disassembled. Lord Winder's objection to servants handling food withered once the food was headed for other people, and so the party spread out a little as the guests pondered the ancient question of how to hold a plate and a glass and eat at the same time without using one of those little glass-holding things that clip on the side of the plate and make the user look as though they're 4 years old.
This takes a lot of concentration, and that might have been why everyone was so curiously self-absorbed. The door opened. A figure walked into the room. Winder looked up over the top of his plate. It was a slim figure, hooded and masked, all in black. Winder stared. Around him, the conversation rose, and a watcher above might have noticed that the drift of the party tides was such that they were leaving a wide, empty path, stretching from the door all the way to Winder, whose legs didn't want to move. As it strolled towards him, the figure reached both hands behind it, and they came back, each holding a small pistol bow. There were a couple of small tick noises, and the bodyguards collapsed gently towards the floor. Then it tossed the bows behind it and kept coming. Its footfalls made no sound. Said Winder, staring. His mouth was open and stuffed with cake. People chattered on. Somewhere, someone had told a joke. There was laughter, perhaps a shade shriller than might normally be the case. The noise level rose again. Winder blinked. Assassins didn't do this. They snuck around. They used the shadows. This didn't happen in real life. This was how it happened in dreams. And now the creature was in front of him. He dropped his spoon, and there was a sudden silence after it clanged on the ground. There was another rule. Whenever possible, the inhumed should be told who the assassin was and who had sent him. It was felt by the guild that this was only fair. Winder did not know this, and it was not widely advertised, but nevertheless, in the midst of terror, eyes wide, he asked the questions.
"Who sent you?"
"I come from the city," said the figure, drawing a thin, silvery sword.
"Who are you?"
"Think of me as your future." The figure drew the sword back, but it was too late. Terror's own, more subtle knife had done its work. Winder's face was crimson. His eyes were staring at nothing, and coming up from the throat, through the crumbs of cake, was a sound that merged a creak with a sigh. The dark figure lowered its sword, watched for a moment in the echoing silence, and then said, "Boo." It reached out one gloved hand and gave the patrician a push. Winder went over backwards, his plate dropping from his hand and shattering on the tiles. The assassin held his bloodless sword at arm's length and let it drop on the floor beside the corpse. Then he turned and walked slowly back across the marble floor. He shut the double doors behind him. Madam counted slowly to 10 before she screamed. That seemed long enough. Lord Winder got to his feet and looked up at the black-clad figure.
"Another one? Where did you creep in from?"
"I do not creep."
Winder's mind felt even fuzzier than it had done over the past few years, but he was certain about cake. He'd been eating cake, and now there wasn't any. Through the mists he saw it, apparently close, but when he tried to reach it, a long way away. A certain realization dawned on him.
"Oh,"
he said.
"Yes,"
said Death.
"Not even time to finish my cake."
"No, there is no more time, even for cake. For you, the cake is over. You have reached the end of cake."
A grapnel thudded into the wall beside Vimes. There were shouts along the barricade. More hooks snaked up and bit into the wood. Another rain of arrows clattered on the roofs of the houses. The attackers weren't ready to risk hitting their own side, but arrows were snapping and bouncing in the street below. Vimes heard shouts and the clang of arrows on armour. A sound made him turn. A helmeted head rose level with his, and the face beneath it blanched in terror when it saw Vimes.
"That was my egg, you bastard!" he screamed, punching the nose. "With soldiers!"
The man fell back, by the sound of it, onto other climbers. Men were yelling all along the parapet. Vimes pulled out his truncheon.
"At 'em, lads," he yelled. "Truncheons, nothing fancy. Bop 'em on the fingers and let gravity do the work. They're going down."
He ducked, pressing close to the wood, and tried to find a spy hole.
"They're using big catapults," said Sandra, who'd found a gap a few feet away. "There's a..."
Vimes pulled her away. "What are you doing still up here?" he roared. "It's safer than the street," she yelled back, nose to nose with him. "Not if one of those grapnels hits you, it isn't."
He grabbed his knife. "Here, take this. You see a rope anywhere, cut it." He scurried along behind the shelter of the wobbling parapet, but the defenders were doing very well. It wasn't exactly rocket magic in any case. The people at ground level were firing out through any crack they could find, and while aiming was not easy, it didn't need to be. There is nothing like the zip and zing of arrows around them to make people nervous at their work. And the climbers were too bunched up. They had to be. If they tried attacking on a broad front, there'd be three defenders to greet each man. So they were in one another's way, and every falling man would take a couple more down with him. And the barricade was full of little gaps and holes where a defender with a spear could seriously prod those trying to climb up the outside. This is stupid, Vimes thought. It'd take 1,000 men to break through, and that'd only be when the last 50 ran up the slope made of the bodies of all the rest of them. Someone out there is doing the old hit them at their strongest point to show them we mean business thinking. Ye gods, is this how we won our wars? So how would I have dealt with this? Well, I'd have said, Detritus, remove the barricade, and made sure the defenders heard me. That's what I would have done. End of problem. There was a scream from further along the parapet. A grapnel had caught one of the watchmen and pulled him hard against the wood. Vimes reached him in time to see a hook dragged into the man's body, through breastplate and mail, as an attacker hauled himself up. Vimes caught the man's sword arm in one hand and punched him with the other, letting him tumble into the melee below. The stricken watchman was Nancy Ball. His face was blue-white, his mouth opened and shut soundlessly, and blood pooled around his feet. It dripped through the planks.
"Let's get the bloody thing out," Wiglet said, grabbing the hook. Vimes pushed him away as a couple of arrows hummed overhead. "That could do more damage. Call up some lads, take him down really carefully, and get him to Lorne."
Vimes snatched up Nancy Ball's truncheon and brought it down on the helmet of another struggling climber.
"He's still breathing, Sarge?" said Wiglet.
"Right," said Vimes. It was amazing how willing people were to see life in the corpse of a friend.
"So make yourself useful and get him down to the doctor."
And speaking as one who'd seen some stricken men in his time, he mentally added, "And if Lorne can sort him out, he can start his own religion." A lucky attacker who'd achieved the top of the barricade and then found himself horribly alone slashed desperately at Vimes with his sword. Vimes turned back to business. Ankh-Morpork was good at this, and had become good at it without anyone ever discussing it. Things flowed rather than happened. That is, you'd sometimes have to look quite hard to find the point of change between hasn't been done yet and already taken care of, old boy. And that was how it was done. Things were taken care of. It was 20 minutes before Mr. Snapcase arrived, and 25 minutes before he was duly sworn in as patrician, had magically become Lord Snapcase, and was sitting in the oblong office. This included the 1 minute silence for the late Lord Winder, whose body had been taken care of. A number of servants were shown the door without any great unpleasantness, and even Spymold was allowed to remove his toad farm in peace. But those who filled the grates and dusted the furniture and swept the floors stayed on, as they had stayed on before, because they seldom paid any attention to, or possibly didn't even know, who their lord was, and in any case were too useful and knew where the brooms were kept. Men come and go, but dust accumulates.